Okay, so the story I want to focus on this week is a story that maybe is maybe a little bit less known than the stories we've done the last 2 weeks, than the splitting of the sea, or the story of David and Goliath, and that is the epic battle, or shall we say non-battle, between Hezekiah, between King Chizkiah, and Sanherib, and Sennacherib, the king of Assyria. Now, I tried to find a good picture for it, but I was also running out of space. I tried to include some capturing of this moment in culture outside of Torah. So the last 2 weeks I did art. This week, this story was famous enough that the most famous piece of art about it is not actually a painting, it's a poem by Lord Byron. So that I did include. That's on page 2, the Destruction of Sennacherib by Lord Byron. This is a less well-known story, but a very important story, a fascinating tale, to the point where there's a book, I don't know if you've ever seen it, it's called The What If, Eminent Historians Weigh In on Something, on Great Historical Events or something like that. It's a book of what would have happened if certain critical moments in history had happened differently. So they have a chapter on what happens if Winston Churchill, there was an attempted assassination, what happens if he had actually been assassinated? How would the world change? So the first chapter in that book is by a Professor McNeil, who argues that the single most important historical event was this battle between Hezekiah and Sennacherib, and had it happened differently, the history of monotheism would have been changed. So it's a story that's worth reading. Even if that historical claim is not true, I have no idea. These hypotheticals, I never know how to quite assess them. But at any rate, it's a fascinating story. And Tanakh devotes many, many chapters to this story. There's 3 or 4 chapters in the Book of Kings. There's 3 or 4 chapters in the Book of Chronicles, and several chapters in the book of Isaiah that all tell this story from different vantage points. But Hezekiah is one of the heroes of Tanakh. So a little bit of background. So the monarchy of the Jewish people, so the first king in Israel, which God isn't so thrilled that they're asking for a king at all, but they ask God for a king, so we get Saul. Then Saul has one son who does become king for a short period of time, Ish-bosheth, but because Saul sins, so the monarchy is given over to David. David rules over all of Israel, as does his son Shlomo. But then Shlomo's son, Solomon's son, Rehavam, is a bit greedy for taxes, gets into a bit of a fight with the people, so Yeravam ben Nevat challenges his throne. And the kingdom splits between the northern kingdom of what becomes known as Israel, because the majority of the Jewish people, 10 out of the 12 tribes. And then there's the kingdom of Judah, which follows the Davidic monarchy, which is the descendants of King David, obviously. So it's the tribe of Judah from which the Davidic monarchy comes, and the tribe of Benjamin, of Benjamin. Now, there's a lot of sin and idol worship going on in both kingdoms, but it's particularly bad amongst the kings of Israel. But it's decently bad amongst the kings of Judah as well. So one of the worst of the kings of Judah is Ahaz. Now Ahaz is the father of Hezekiah. So Ahaz is pretty bad. But Hezekiah, or Chizkiyahu, is really, really good. He's the hero. Because, as we'll see, his father is involved in idol worship, and he gets rid of all the idol worship, and he cleans up the country, and he carries out huge religious reforms. And after those religious reforms, we get to a showdown between him and Assyria, which leads us to one more piece of background, which is, if you think about, right, Israel has historically always been very important, not a very powerful nation, but an important nation because it is the bridge between Asia and between Africa. So they're always involved in these complicated military alliances with the world superpowers, which at this point in history, the world superpowers were Egypt, but the real superpower was Assyria. Right? Assyria under Sennacherib, and really even before that under Sargon II, was conquering the entire known world, and they were just sweeping through the area and conquering everybody. So now the prophets in general, though, really didn't like getting involved in any international treaties. They got really angry at the kings every time they did. They said it's not worth it. If you get involved with Egypt, you'll get Assyria mad. You get involved with Assyria, you'll get Egypt mad. Besides, you should just be relying on God and just stay out of all of these things. So this is the political and religious background we need to know to understand this story. Okay, that's the background. So, you know, let's see. Okay. Now, at the end of this whole story, what we're going to get to is this battle between, which never happens, but the potential battle between Hezekiah and Sennacherib. But if you look at the Talmud in number one, the Talmud sees this moment, and what we want to try to do is understand this moment as a almost messianic moment, right? The Holy One, blessed be He, wanted to appoint Hezekiah as the Messiah and Sennacherib as Gog and Magog. Right? This moment could have been the end of days. Chizkiyahu could have been, right, Mashiach ben David, right? He is a descendant of David, and he carries out these amazing religious reforms, and Sennacherib is this superpower conquering the whole world, this evil anti-God figure, as we'll see. He could have been the fulfillment of Gog and Magog. Whereupon the attribute of justice said before the Holy One, blessed be He, Sovereign of the universe, if thou did not make David the Messiah, who uttered so many hymns and psalms before thee, right? You didn't make David the Messiah. You didn't end history with King David, and he wrote the book of Psalms. He praised you all the time, and Hezekiah doesn't. Will that appoint Hezekiah as such, who did not hymn thee in spite of all the miracles that wrought is for him, right? He doesn't sing. Now, there's something about the fact that Hezekiah doesn't sing after this battle that the rabbis see as this lost opportunity that could have changed history, and it didn't. So what I want to do is try to understand that moment. What is it about this victory and Hezekiah's response that made the rabbis see it as this amazing moment? So now let's actually read the story. I've put parts of the story. What I've done is a bit of cheating here, because as I said, the story appears in three different books with different vantage points, but I've tried to weave together a story from different passages in the three stories, following basically an analysis by Rabbi David Foreman that he presented over the summer, which I think is very powerful in understanding the story. Okay, so number two. First, before we get to Hezekiah, so as I said, we need to understand how bad his father was. His father was terrible. His father, Ahaz, is really, really bad. So in 2 Kings, we hear as follows. He did not do what was pleasing to the Lord his God, as his ancestor David had done, but followed the ways of the kings of Israel. So, many of the kings of Judah had been better than the kings of Israel. They hadn't worshipped idols, but Ahaz says, forget it. Right? Forget it, I am going to worship idols just like the kings of Israel. And he does something else wrong. He also gets involved in shady international treaties, which the prophets don't like. So in verse 5, you find out that King Rezin of Aram and King Pekah, son of Remaliah, right, Pekah bin Remaliahu of Israel, advanced on Jerusalem for battle. They besieged Ahaz, but they could not overcome him. Right, so he ends up in this battle, right, where the king of Aram and the king of Israel, right, because often Israel and Judah would fight against each other, came and besieged him, and he couldn't fight them. So what did he do? So he decided, well, what's the best way to beat enemies? If you're not strong enough yourself, yeah, ally with somebody else. So who's the superpower? The superpower is Assyria. So he sends messengers to Ahaz sends messengers to King Tiglath-Pileser of Assyria to say, I am your servant and your son. Come and deliver me from the hands of the king of Aram and from the hands of the king of Israel who are attacking me. And Ahaz took the gold and silver that were on hand in the house of the Lord and the treasuries of the royal palace and sent them as a gift to the king of Assyria. And the king of Assyria responded to his request. So he just writes a letter and he says, you know, forget it. I'm going to bribe Assyria and they're going to save me. I will be their servant. I'll be a vassal state to Assyria. I don't care, but I don't want to die. Now this, by the way, was totally standard in the ancient world. This is totally standard. It happens all the time. I never really understood these conversations. So these conversations, modern times, you know, you think about how conversations go now between diplomats. It's never, I'll be your servant. It's really, we have shared interests in the region. Really, right? It's all, you know, it's all like this, you know, even if you understand that really what it is look, we'll, you know, we'll be not your servants, but we'll be, you know, your, yeah, well, but the weaker part of the ally, and we'll listen to what you say. That's never how it's framed. It's we have shared alliances, we have shared interests, right? I mean, think away, you know, Israel talk and the states always talk, right? It's never, you know, no one ever says in America, we are the superpower and we are your patron, even though America is a patron of Israel. That's what it is, it's, right? They say it's the only democracy in the Middle East, we have shared interests in the region, which is sort of true, right? But you never say out loud that, you know, we're the patron and you are, you know, the beneficiary, and therefore you basically do what we say. Even if it's true, you don't say it, right? In the ancient world, you just said it. And I didn't realize this until I read Thucydides, right? If you read Thucydides, it's like, you know, whatever, it's 1,500 pages or whatever it is, the history of the Peloponnesian Wars, then you realize that that's how things go, right? It's the whole book is filled with these poetic reconstructions of conversations that states would have with Athens and with Sparta and with Persia, right, with the superpowers. We're weak, but we like you better than, you know, Sparta, so save us, and we'll send you this much money a year. And Athens says, it's great, right? Or Athens will initiate. Look, you are next to Sparta, you don't like Sparta, we'll protect you, give us this much money. Or, if you don't give us this money, we'll kill you, or whatever. It's very, right, everything is very, very straightforward. So, this is par for the course. Ahaz tells Assyria, look, I need help, I'll bribe you, you save me from my enemies, I'll be your vassal state. End of story. So that's what happens. But then Ahaz goes further. So when Ahaz went to Damascus to greet King Tiglath-Pileser of Assyria, he saw the altar in Damascus. And King Ahaz sent the priest Uriah a sketch of the altar and a detailed plan of its construction. The priest Uriah did just as King Ahaz had instructed him from Damascus. The priest Uriah built the altar before King Ahaz returned from Damascus. So he didn't just become a vassal state. He said, I am going to be totally and completely subservient to Assyria. And without even being asked, what I'm going to do is I'm going to accept the gods of Assyria. I'm going to, he went to Damascus, he saw what their idol looked like their, you know, their altar looked like. He said, okay, I'm going to put that in the Beit HaMikdash. I'm going to put that in the temple, and I'm going to worship the gods of Assyria. I'm going to be subservient to Assyria.
In the temple, right?
He sent it to the priest, and he says, right, forget it. And if you think about it, there's a twisted logic here, which is, in the ancient world, if you were a polytheist, so you believed that there were multiple gods, and whoever god happened to be ascendant at that time, he would win. So if Assyria is ascendant, and you've allied yourself with Assyria, so then you ally yourself with the god of Assyria as well. So you take his altar, you make a replica of it, you put it in the temple, and either you only worship him, or you worship him and you worship, you know, our god, because if you're a polytheist, there's no contradiction between saying, okay, I worship multiple gods, worship the god of Israel and the god of Assyria, right? But you give up on the notion that there's one god. So Ahaz is terrible, right? Yeah?
How come the priest and he were not struck dead when they entered the temple?
Another altar? I mean, there is, but, you know, God doesn't always magically, you know, kill people. He lets people, you know, lets people do what they ever want to do. So, right, and in Isaiah, you find out that he was warned, right, not to enter into these alliances, right? Like, Isaiah told him, look, if you have courage and stand up to them, you'll be okay. Just don't give up. Don't give in and, you know, offer yourself to Assyria. But he doesn't. So Ahaz is terrible. This is the background of Chizkiyahu. Now, Chizkiyah becomes king at a very young age, right? Did I put the verse here? I hope I did. But I cut it because, you know, for space. But if I remember, he's 15. As he becomes king, he's 15 and he's king for 29 years. He dies at 44. Which is, you know, actually not such a short time in that period. 44 is, you know, that's about average. But he becomes king at 15. So you would think that if someone becomes king at 15 and your father you know, set out a certain path, you would follow that path. Like, you're not going to strike out on your own as a teenager. Or maybe you would. You're a teenager. I don't know. But he does. So Chizkiyahu decides, forget it. I am done with this. And especially in the book of Chronicles, Chizkiyah is the hero of the book. So Hezekiah, now this is source 3. Hezekiah did what was pleasing to the Lord, just as his father David had done. He, in the first month of the first year of his reign, so he's 15, right? And right off the bat, right, he, you know, like, everyone was shocked. Usually you become, you know, ruler, it takes a few months to get used to things. Like, everyone was shocked when this was true both for President Obama and for President Trump, right? In the first 2 weeks, they you know, signed whatever it was. President Trump was, what, 18 executive orders, and President Obama was 19 executive orders. Right off the bat, you're changing the vision from the previous president, because both of them, you know, whether you like them or not, both of them ran campaigns that I am not the person who preceded me, right? Okay. So Chizkiyahu does the same thing. He gets out right off the bat. He's 15 years old. First month of the first year of his reign, he opens the doors of the house of the Lord and repaired them. He goes straight to the Beit HaMikdash and he starts fixing it. But then he starts a national revolution. So he doesn't do this himself. First, he summoned the priests and the Levites and assembled them in the East Square. And he said to them, "Listen to me, Levites. Sanctify yourself and sanctify the house of the Lord, God of your fathers, and take the abhorrent things out of the holy place. For our fathers trespassed and did what displeased the Lord our God. They forsook him and turned their faces away from the dwelling place of the Lord, turned their backs on it." So first he gets the Levites and said, "Everything my father put in here, out. Everything out. Right? I want you to clean this place up." Right? He continues, "Now I wish to make a covenant with the Lord God of Israel so that his rage may be withdrawn from us." And he says something, right? Then he says something shocking. But what does he say? Right? He says, "Why do I want to do this? Because God is angry with us." Now this is very strange, right? I mean, Chizkiyah, how did he know that? Right? Ahaz, his father, saw the world in polytheistic lens. Right? He said, "Well, we're losing, so it must be that our God, it's not that he's angry with us, that our God is weak. So let me ally myself with Assyria." But Chizkiyah says, "No. My father had just the wrong view of the world. The reason there are problems is not because God is weak, it's because God is angry with us, because we're not doing the right thing." Right? Right? He takes the monotheistic position, right? There is one God, but if things are happening bad to you, it's not because your God is weak, it's because your God is angry. He said, I am going to make his rage withdraw from us. "Now, my sons, do not be slack, for the Lord chose you to attend upon him, to serve him, to be his ministers, and to make offerings to him." So then the verses describe what actually happens. And in 18, they come and they tell him. They went to the palace of King Hezekiah and said, "We have purified the whole house of the Lord and the altar of burnt offering and all its utensils and the table of the bread of display and all its utensils and all the utensils that King Ahaz had befouled during his reign when he trespassed, we have made ready and sanctified. They are standing in front of the altar of the Lord." They come in and they said, "We did it. Wait, we did it. It's fixed. Everything your father messed up, we sanctified. Every idol that was there, we got rid of. The temple is ready." So, yeah. No, it's about the covenant, and that's what he's about to do, right? And that's what we're going to see, is he means it. He says he wants to reforce the covenant. Basically, what Hezekiah sees, and we'll see this in just a moment, is he says, "Well, basically, my father broke the terms of our covenant with God. So I'm going to do a renewal of vows, as it were. Right? I'm going to renew the vows of our covenant with God. So first things first, I'm going to clean up his house. Right? His house is a mess. It's filled with idols. I'm cleaning it up." But then he continues. "King Hezekiah rose early, gathered the officers of the city, and went up to the house of the Lord. They brought 7 bulls and 7 rams and 7 lambs and 7 he-goats as a sin offering for the kingdom and for the sanctuary and for Judah." He goes and he brings offerings. And he specifically brings, among other things, sin offerings. Right? He basically turns to God and says, "Look, we made a mistake, right? But I'm cleaning up your temple and I'm bringing offerings. We're going to make things right." And all the congregation prostrated themselves, and song was sung, and trumpets were blown, and all this until the end of the burnt offering. But he's not done. Right? If you follow what's happening, and I give you a summary of it at the end, right? Hezekiah wants to really bring about change. So, right, when you want to bring about change, right, what do? Right? So first, right, you change yourself, right? Then you change your family, and then you can change your community, and then you can change the world, right? Or at least that's how we say, right? It's not actually true. As one of my teachers once said, wisely, but a little bit cynically, right? Because most people say, right, I tried to change the world, and I couldn't change the world, so I changed my community. I couldn't change my community, so I changed my family. I couldn't change my family, so I worked on myself. But he said, that's not really how the world works. The hardest thing to do is change yourself. What really happens is you try to change yourself. That doesn't work. So you say, okay, I can't change myself. I'll change my family. You realize that doesn't work, right? So then you go and you change your community. You realize that doesn't work. So then you go and you change the world, right? I'll donate to whatever, you know, to money or something in Africa. That's much easier than actually working on local problems, right? Saying you're giving money to some big global problem makes you feel good. It's easier, right? So there's a lot of wisdom to that, but that's not what Chizkiah is doing, right? Chizkiah starts with himself, and he commits to God. And then who does he turn to? The Levites, right? The Levites and the priests, right? So if you think of concentric circles, right? He starts with the logical people who should, right, be in charge of this relationship, but that's not enough. Then he turns to all the people in the city, or the officers, and he turns to everyone in Jerusalem and says, you too, I want you to recommit to God. And then he decides that's not enough. I want everyone. And who's everyone? So everyone is for sure the kingdom of Judah. That makes sense. He's the king of Judah. Right? So it's not just enough the capital city has repented. He wants all of Judah. But he does something no one else has done. At this point, Judah and Israel have been separate kingdoms for hundreds of years. Hundreds of years. And if you go back in history, when Yeravam became king, when Yeravam first split from the kingdom of Judah. So we find out in the book of Kings that he was very smart. And he said, wait a second, what's going to happen? I've split from the king of Judah, but where's the temple? In Judah, in Jerusalem, under the auspices of Judah. What's going to happen? It's going to come time for Pesach, and everybody's going to want to go to the temple, and everyone's going to go to Jerusalem. What are they all going to wake up to? They're all going to realize that I don't really deserve the throne. Right? Because if we leave the temple in Judah, so it may be the rest of the year they're willing to have me as their political leader, but if in order to serve God they need to go to Jerusalem, they're going to realize that I'm only second best. So he realized what he needed to do was, right? Yeah, exactly. We need to replace the temple in Jerusalem. So that's what he does. He sets up two calves, golden calves, one in the north and one in the south, and says, instead of going to Jerusalem, worship them. Right? The imagery is striking, right? He takes golden calves and he sets them up to replace the temple in Jerusalem. And it works, right? And that's the beginning of the idolatrous streak in the kingdom of Israel, because it's founded on the notion that to replace the monarchy, you also have to replace the divine right of the monarchy. So you have to not go to Jerusalem. But Hezekiah decides that, you know what, if I really want to reform, I got to do something radical. And not only am I going to tell the Levites and the priests and my own kingdom that it's time to turn back to God, I'm going to turn back the clock 500 years. And I'm going to, for the first time, send messengers to the kingdom of Israel and tell them, I want you to join me as Jews, right? As if we were still one united people, and go back to God. Now this is really quite radical, right? If you think about it, we're so used to the fact that now, like, oh, well, yeah, there was the kingdom of Israel and kingdom of Judah, but they were all Jews. But that's not how they viewed it, right? Like, they were separate kingdoms for hundreds of years. This is like, you know, the modern equivalent would be like, I don't know, trying to get India and Pakistan to agree. Like, oh yeah, you know, at some point we all like, you know, or I don't know, go back to the Ottoman Empire, right? Well, really, we're all part of the Ottoman Empire, right? So Turkey and whoever else is part of the Ottoman Empire, we should, right? And Israel, right? You should get along, right? Why do you have differences? You're all the former Ottoman Empire, right? Or you know, or try getting everyone who was at one point under the British Empire to agree, right? Oh yeah, the United States 300 years ago was under the British Empire. Not quite 300, but almost 300, right? 200, okay, whatever. Since 1776, right? We have not been in the British Empire. But, you know, we were once the British Empire, and so was India, and so was, you know, Egypt, and so was Jordan, and so was, you know, the list goes on. We should just act as if we're one nation, you know? We'll share intelligence, we'll share, you know? That's not how the world works. Like, if for hundreds of years you've been separate, then you're separate. But Hezekiah says, no, I'm going to turn back the clock 500 years. So Hezekiah, if we continue, sent word to all of Israel and Judah, and he wrote letters to Ephraim and Manasseh, meaning tribes from Israel, to come to the house of the Lord in Jerusalem to keep the Passover for the Lord God of Israel. The king and his officers and the congregation in Jerusalem had agreed to keep the Passover in the second month. Right? Without getting to all the details of it, right? Normally Passover is in Nisan, in the first Jewish month, but he does it in the second month because he wants to give people time to purify so he can get as many people as part of this renewal of the covenant, which he's going to do with the Paschal sacrifice, which makes sense. That was the first sacrifice we brought as a Jewish people. He wants to use it symbolically to renew our vows with God. The Talmud has a long discussion of whether he was right to wait to the second month and what exactly it means he waited to the second month, but let's just leave it for now that he gives an extra month to ensure that everybody can come. For at that time, they were unable to keep it, for not enough priests had sanctified themselves, nor the people assembled in Jerusalem. The couriers went out with the letters from the king and his officers through all of Israel and Judah by order of the king, proclaiming, O you Israelites, return to the Lord, God of your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, and he will return to the remnant of you who escaped from the hands of the kings of Assyria. Do not be like your fathers and brothers who trespassed against the Lord God of their fathers, and he turned them into horror as you see. As the couriers passed from town to town in the land of Ephraim and Manasseh till they reached Zebulun, they were laughed at and mocked. Right, so right, Hezekiah tries to bring back the northern tribes, but they don't want any of it, right? We've been separate for hundreds of years. What is this? Right? And they laughed at him. But some of the people of Asher and Manasseh and Zebulun, however, were contrite and came to Jerusalem. But he was successful in bringing some people back. And there was great rejoicing in Jerusalem, for since the time of King Solomon, son of David of Israel, nothing like it had happened in Jerusalem. So Hezekiah is a hero. He's a religious hero, right? The Book of Chronicles loves him, right? He manages to reach out, not just to, right, not just himself turn to God, reach out to the priests, to the Levites, to his capital city, to his kingdom. For the first time, he even gets some members of the kingdom of Israel to come back, turn back the clock several hundred years, and recommit to God. And he has this mass paschal offering, communal paschal offering in Jerusalem, a renewal of vows with God, a renewal of the covenant, and everything is great. But, and this is where we get to the battle. He decides that as part of this, as we've said, one of the things that the prophets really didn't like was the treaties and really the subservience to foreign powers. So as part of his renewal, he decides he's going to rebel against Assyria. Now, it's not really clear what he does. Right, he may rebel by himself, or he may rebel by uniting with Egypt against Assyria. It's not totally clear. The Assyrians assume, this is one of those problems, is that as we'll see, the Assyrians assume he has allied himself with Egypt, but we don't know whether that's true or not. Right, the Tanakh never tells us explicitly whether they just assumed he had allied with Egypt and that's why he had the audacity to fight them, or he hadn't. But whatever it is, he rebels as part of this revolution. He rebels against Assyria. And this doesn't go well, right? It never goes quite well to rebel against the world superpower. So in source number 4, this is what happens. In the 14th year of King Hezekiah, King Sennacherib of Assyria marched against all the fortified towns of Judah and seized them. So he goes and he starts conquering the cities of Judah. King Hezekiah sent this message to the king of Assyria at Lachish. So he sends a message to him, and he says, you know what, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done that. That was a bad idea. Right? That was a bad idea. I should not have rebelled against you. I've done wrong. Withdraw from me, and I shall bear whatever you impose on me. And I'll pay you off. So the king of Assyria imposed upon King Hezekiah of Judah a payment of 300 talents of silver and 30 talents of gold, which is a fortune and a half. So Hezekiah gave him all the silver that was on hand in the house of the Lord and in the treasuries of the palace. At that time, Hezekiah cut down the doors and the doorposts of the temple of the Lord, which King Hezekiah had overlaid with gold, and gave them to King Assyria, the king of Assyria. So he starts to backtrack. So what am I supposed to do, right? To save the lives of Judah, money, it's just money, right? Just money. I'll pay Assyria off and we'll continue with our religious revolution. But it's tragic, right? He has to send back money. He even has to take the gold off the doors of the temple that he had, just renewed. But that's not enough. He sends the money. The king of Assyria sent the Tartan, the Rabsaris, and Rabshakeh from Lachish. He sent some of his officers with a large force to King Hezekiah in Jerusalem. Right? Assyria is not happy with this. Said, I'll take your money, but I'm not gonna give up. They march up to Jerusalem, and Rabshakeh said to them, "You tell Hezekiah." Right, so Hezekiah is not there, right? He's in his palace in Jerusalem. But Assyria sends the messengers to the walls of Jerusalem. It's a fortified city. Right? They send and there's officers on the wall, and they scream up to them and they say, "You tell your king. Thus said the great king, the king of Assyria, what makes you so confident that you've rebelled against me?" Right? I'm not happy with this because, okay, so now you've paid me money, but you know what? It really bothers me. Like, who do you think you are? Right? He's a tiny little kingdom in the south of Israel, right? And you rebelled against Assyria? What are you relying on? You rely of all things on Egypt, that splintered reed of a staff? It's like insulting. He assumes, again, we don't know whether this is true or not. He assumes the only reason he would have this chutzpah was because he had allied himself with Egypt. He said, Egypt, you think you're going to, right? He gives him the image. You think Egypt is going to be your cane? It'll support you? He's a reed. You're going to hold on to him, you're going to fall down. Right, which enters and punctures the palm of anyone who leans on it, right? It's a reed with thorns, right? You're going to fall down, you're going to hurt yourself because you're rebelling against me. That's what Pharaoh, king of Egypt, is to all who rely on him. And if you tell me, maybe you'll tell me it's not Egypt. You're going to tell me that you're relying on the Lord your God? Please. He is the very one whose shrines and altars Hezekiah did away with. So, I hadn't put this before, but one of the things that Hezekiah did as far as the revolution was he didn't just get rid of the idols. He got rid of the individual altars to God around the country because he forced everyone to come back to the temple, which is what they're supposed to do. But for polytheists, this was crazy. Like, why would you get rid of private altars to God? You want God to be angry with you, right? The notion that you should have a central place of worship, right? That was crazy. So he said, you're relying on God. Hezekiah got rid of his private altars, telling Judah and Jerusalem, you must worship only at his altar in Jerusalem. You think your God is happy with you? So then, in the middle, in the ellipsis here, you have this very disturbing conversation where he's beginning to talk, right? He's yelling. So at some point, the officers say to him, they said, look, listen, do us a favor. Speak in Aramaic, right? Aramaic was the political language, like English is now. I speak in it. The people don't understand it. Tell us the message, and we'll tell King Hezekiah what you want. But just don't teach. Don't speak in Hebrew. We don't need everybody to hear what you're saying. So Rabshakeh says to him, "What do you mean? I want everybody to understand." And then he turns to them, and I cut out the very crude parts of it, right? But he says, I want them to hear what's going to happen to them, the people who are going to end up drinking their urine and eating their feces because of how bad I'm going to treat them. Right? He uses very crude language, to the point where when we read the Tanakh, we don't actually read the words that are written there. We use euphemisms. Right? He uses the modern equivalent of curse words. Right? You can imagine what he's saying. Right? I want them all to hear what's going to happen to them if they don't rebel against Hezekiah. So in 28, and the Rabshakeh stood and called out in a loud voice in Judean. So he called out in Hebrew. Hear the words of the great king, the king of Assyria. Thus said the king, don't let Hezekiah deceive you, for he will not be able to deliver you from my hands. Don't let Hezekiah make you rely on the Lord, saying, the Lord will surely save us. This city will not fall into the hands of the king of Assyria. Don't listen to Hezekiah. For thus said the king of Assyria, make your peace with me and come out to me, so that you may all eat from your vines and eat your fig trees and drink water from your cisterns. Right? If you rebel against Hezekiah, don't worry. I'll take care of you. I'm not going to leave you here. I'm going to exile you, but I'll exile you to a good place. It'll be a good place. Right? You'll be wealthy there. And then he says, and what, you think God's going to save you? Did any of the gods of other nations save his land from the king of Assyria? But the people were silent and did not say a word in reply, for the king's order was do not answer him. So now their religious revolution comes to a fore, right? Assyria is standing outside, and Assyria is telling them explicitly that this is not just a battle. This is a religious battle. Assyria is insulted by the notion that Hezekiah thinks he can carry out a religious revolution and he can commit himself to God, and now he thinks that he's powerful enough to kill Assyria. Right? And if you notice, what did he call himself over and over again? Rabshakeh, what does he refer to Sennacherib as? The great king, Hamelech HaGadol. Right? You think you have a great God, a great king? You don't have anybody, right? The great king is Assyria. You have the chutzpah to think that you recommit yourself to God and that's going to help you? Please. Right? Just watch what I'm going to do to you and your God. But the people have courage because Hezekiah had been successful, right? They were faithful to him and they were faithful to God, so they say nothing. So that's what Hezekiah said. But now it's going to be put to the test. Who's going to win? God or Assyria or Sennacherib? So when King Hezekiah heard this, he rent his clothes and covered himself with sackcloth and went into the house of the Lord. Right, so he says, you know what? I got to pray. And he has his whole prayer to God and he says, look, you know I did this for your sake, right? Your honor is at stake. Listen to what Assyria is saying about you, right? Save us. For your sake. So Isaiah said to them, so Isaiah comes and he says, tell your master as follows, thus said the Lord, do not be frightened by the words of blasphemy against me that you have heard from the minions of the king of Assyria. Don't worry, God is going to make good on his promise. So that night an angel of the Lord went out and struck down 185,000 of the Assyrian camp. And the following morning they were all dead corpses. There's no battle, right? No guns shot. God brings the angel of death, and he wakes up, and 185,000 Assyrian soldiers that had surrounded the small city of Jerusalem are dead. It's over. It's done. And so King Sennacherib of Assyria broke camp and retreated and stayed in Nineveh. He was worshiping in the temple of his god Nisroch. His sons, I can't even pronounce that, Ardarmalech and Sarezer struck him down with a sword. They fled to the land of Ararat, and his son, Esar-Adon, succeeded him as king. So what happens? They all die. Sennacherib retreats, goes home, and his sons assassinate him. Right? It actually takes a few years till that happens, but in the words of Tanakh, right, we just go quickly, right? But that's it. Right? He's saved. Right? It all works. Everyone fell. And this is where I gave you in 5. This moment is captured by Lord Byron. It's much better in a British accent. You can go on YouTube. You can listen to it minute and a half in British accent. I can't do it, but I'll read it anyways. The Assyrians came down like the wolf on the fold, and his cohorts were gleaming in purple and gold, and the sheen of their spears was like stars on the sea when the blue waves roll nightly on deep Galilee. Like the leaves of the forest when summer is green, that host with their banners at sunset were seen. Like the leaves of the forest when autumn hath blown, that host on the morrow lay withered and strown. For the angel of death spread his wings on the blast and breathed in the face of the foe as he passed. And the eyes of the sleepers waxed deadly and chill, and their hearts but once heaved and forever grew still. And there lay the steed with his nostrils all wide, but through it there rolled not the breath of his pride. And the foam of his gasping lay white on the turf, and cold as the spray of the rock-beating surf. And there lay the rider distorted and pale, with the dew on his brow and the rust on his mail. And the tents were all silent, the banners alone, the lances unlifted, the trumpets unblown. And the windows of Ashur are loud in their wail, and the idols are broke in the temple of Baal. And the might of the Gentile, unsmote by the sword, hath melted like snow in the glance of the Lord. Right? Lord Byron captures this moment, right? It's a beautiful poem. It's a very well done poem. Not that Lord Byron needs my needs me to say that, but okay, right? And this is right. This is it, right? Hezekiah has brought about this revolution, and the great superpower comes. Right? He sends him money, sends him a bribe. There's no last hope. He comes to Jerusalem and he says, "I'm going to kill you because you have no hope. You think God can save you? He can't." Hezekiah turns to God and said, "Now is the time to test that theory," right? And the next day, everybody's dead. It's done. It's over. He retreats. He's assassinated, right, by his own children, which, to be fair, was not uncommon in the ancient world. And that's it. And he wins. He wins. And to the end of Chizkiah's life, there's peace in Judah. Not afterwards, but in his life, there is somewhat peace. Now, you look at this story, and, you know, the message is, you know, pretty clear, right? You can win if God is on your side. If you commit to God, all will be good. Especially in Chronicles, right? They make the message very clear. Now, this is why this Professor McNeil says that this moment was so important. Because just a few decades later, the Jews are going to go into exile. And, you know, what are the Jews... What if this battle hadn't happened... So what would the Jews think? We went into exile. They would assume, well, you know, we must have been wrong. We thought we served this all-powerful God, but apparently not, because we were just beaten, and all the Jewish people are off in exile, right, in Babylon. But he says, well, but that's not what happened. What did the Jews instead do when they got to Babylon? What did they say? If we're in exile, it must be because God is angry with us. And so they stayed committed to God throughout the exile, which was unheard of in the ancient world, right? Who can stay committed to a God when you got kicked out? Your God was beaten, right? But they said, no, our God isn't beaten. And they went back 70 years later, and they rebuilt the temple, and they started again. And he said that nation, right, gives birth to two more monotheistic religions who believe that you can have ups and downs, and just because you have a down doesn't mean that God is not with you. And he said, well, where did the world learn that God can do anything but won't always? From this moment. Because here it was. This was the showdown of the world's greatest superpower and a weak little kingdom in Judah who only had God on their side. He just says no. He said, but where did people learn that God can do anything, he just won't always? Here. Because they saw that he could do it. If he wanted to, he could take the world's superpower and without even lifting a gun, without lifting a sword, they would just disappear. They would melt. It would be done. So then, even though, yes, just a few decades later, they're conquered by Babylon, they're sent into exile, they have the historical courage to say, we know that God could have beat Nebuchadnezzar. He could have beat you. If he didn't, it must be we did something wrong. We've seen that he could do it. He did it to Assyria because we were righteous, because we had just reformed. Now we must not be. So they went into exile. They repented. They went back. They built a temple 70 years later. So this Professor McNeil says, yeah, this lesson... Now he said, he's not a believer, right? He said, I'm not a believer. I don't know what happened. I don't know whether this was a miracle or it was a disease. I don't know what happened. But he said, it doesn't matter what happened, right? He said, the lesson that the world learned from it enabled Judaism, Christianity, and Islam to exist, even in down times. Now, if you are a believer, then you say, yeah, right? That the lesson they learned was a good one, right? It was a real one, right? That Jews can be victorious, even under the most unlikely of circumstances, if God is with them. But sometimes God says no, right? He doesn't say no here. He said yes here, but he said no later on. And therefore, the lesson forever is that, you know, you have to, right? Real success comes from commitment to God. But sometimes he'll say no. But that doesn't mean that God lost, because God can do anything. And that was what they learned from this. But you look at this story, it's an amazing story. But then the rabbis, as we saw, said something very surprising. It was what we started with. And they said, this moment could have been, and you understand now why, could have been the end of days. Right? Hezekiah could have been Messiah. Assyria could have been Gog and Magog. Well, you understand why. He's the anti-God. He sets himself up as the anti-God. I am the great king. Don't think God can save you. Right? And he does. Right? God saves them. Right? This is messianic in proportion. Right? And the rabbis say, but it wasn't. Because Hezekiah didn't sing at that moment. Now, what does that mean? Because he praises God the whole time. He's always praising God. But here, he doesn't praise God, and this is it. Right? He doesn't sing. Meaning, he knows it's God. He just prayed to God and said, do this for your own sake. Like, what is going on? So, right, David Foreman suggests that to understand what the rabbis are getting at, you need to look at 6. Because this isn't the end of the story. It's almost the end of the story. The miracles aren't over quite yet. So, in those days, Hezekiah fell dangerously ill. Right after this, he gets sick. Gets very sick. And the prophet Isaiah, son of Amoz, comes to him and said, thus said the Lord, set your affairs in order, for you're going to die. You will not get well. Right, he's dying. Okay. So thereupon, Hezekiah turned his face to the wall and prayed to the Lord. Hezekiah said, I don't care what you say. I don't care what you say. You're telling me prophetically that I'm going to die? I don't think that's true. I know God can do the impossible. So I'm just going to pray. Right? I'm going to pray. The way the Talmud says it is he turns to Isaiah and says, look, I have a tradition from my father that even if a sword is on your is at your neck, you can pray. Al timnas mecham min arachamim. Don't not pray. If you pray, miracles can happen. So he does. So Hezekiah wept profusely. And before Isaiah had gone out of the middle court, right, he hadn't even left the door. He's like, as Isaiah is walking out of the palace, the word of the Lord came to him. And God says, turn around, right, turn around, go back and say to Hezekiah, the ruler of my people, thus said the Lord, the God of your father David, I have heard your prayer, and I have seen your tears, I'm going to heal you. And you find out, in Chronicles, and not only that, but he says, I'm going to send you a miracle. You know what I'm going to do? You know that sundial on your roof? The sun is going to move, and it's going to be rolled back. Right? It's almost evening, it's going to be rolled back to morning. Right? The sun is going to roll back, you'll see, time is just going to change. We're just going to turn back the clock. Right? The imagery being clear, right? You thought you were at the end of your life, and now, you know, you're not. And the sun is going to show that. Which potentially many people had seen, right? If that miracle happened, right? It's not clear whether that miracle is like a, you know, miracle just in, you know, his court, or it's a miracle that the sun actually moves, in which case the whole world sees it. At that time, King Birodach Baladan, son of Baladan of Babylon, sent envoys with a letter and a gift to Hezekiah. For he had heard about Hezekiah's illness. Right? All these miracles are piling up. And a young power in Babylon is starting to emerge, and they decide, you know what, this is really fascinating. Something is going on there in Judah. And he sends a letter to Hezekiah. He sends an envoy. Hezekiah heard about them, and he showed them all his treasure house. Right? And Hezekiah is ecstatic, right? Like, he's this little weak power, and here, this foreign rising superpower, it's not yet so powerful, but it's rising from far, far away, right? The other side of Mesopotamia, the other side of the Fertile Crescent, comes and sends messengers to see the great kingdom of Judah. So what does he do? What does anybody do? He shows off, right? He brings them in. And Hezekiah heard about them and showed them all his treasure house, the silver, the gold, the spices, the fragrant oil, and his armory, and everything that was found in his storehouses. There was nothing in his palace or in all his realm that Hezekiah did not show them. Then the prophet Isaiah came to King Hezekiah. What, he demanded of him, did those men say to you? Where have they come to you from? They have come, Hezekiah replied, from the far country, from Babylon. Next he said, and what have they seen in your palace? And Hezekiah replied, they have seen everything in my palace. There was nothing in my storehouses that I did not show them. Then Isaiah said to Hezekiah, "Hear the word of the Lord. A time is coming when everything in your palace, which your ancestors have stored up to this day, will be carried off to Babylon. Nothing will remain behind," said the Lord. "And some of your sons, your own issue, whom you have fathered, will be taken to serve as eunuchs in the palace of the king of Babylon. This is the beginning of the end." Well, it's not really clear to translate that word, right? Saris literally means eunuch, right? Because the originally what it referred to was the officers who were in charge of the harem, right? It becomes a generic word to mean any servant. So it's never quite clear whether Saris means actually a eunuch or just a servant in the king's palace, but there'll be servants at least to the king of Babylon. Now, the continuing conversation is actually that Hezekiah says, well, that's good because, you know, at least in my day, everything is good. And as a king, I can only be responsible for what happens in my time. And until the end of my days, everything will be okay. But okay. Now, we find out here that Isaiah is really angry at him. Right? And you wonder why, right? Like, this was natural. Like, Hezekiah is this amazing king. He has this revolution, right? He brings back the priests, and he brings back the Levites, and he brings back his city, and he brings back his kingdom, and he brings back the neighboring kingdom, right? And he is righteous enough that God kills the world superpower at his gates without him having to lift a finger. And now, a messenger comes who's so impressed. He shows him his treasuries, and Isaiah comes, that's it. That's the beginning of the end. Now Babylon is going to come and is going to take everything, and, you know, I just saved you from Assyria, but I'm not going to save you from Babylon, right? Another few decades, and it's all over. And you wonder, like, what did he just do? Yeah.
I think he showed them that
Exactly. Right? And that's what Ray Forman suggests, and that was the problem. Right? He said, but it's a little bit more than that. He said, because what happened? He said, if you think about what we mentioned, what is Hezekiah doing? He's improving the world in concentric circles, right? Himself, then his city, then the Levites in the city, then his kingdom, then the other Jews. Who's the last circle he has to bring back to God? What?
The world.
The world. He has a perfect opportunity. It's a perfect opportunity because he just killed the world superpower. Everyone heard about this. Everyone's hearing about the miracle. He miraculously gets better, right? The sun is moving for him. And he's like, right, everyone wants to be the friends of the Jews at this point, right? Everyone wants to be Hezekiah's friend. How do we know? Babel, right? Babylon sends messengers. They want to hear what happened. How did you get better miraculously? How did you beat Assyria? How did you beat an army of 185,000 people, right, around the old city of Jerusalem? I mean, think about what we're talking, right? They just died one night, you know, and that was it. Like, how did that all happen? And he has an opportunity. What could he have said?
God.
And then he would have brought in the last circle. And that would have been, what would that have been? If he brought in the world, if he'd managed to educate the far-off country of Babylon, that God runs the world, what would that have brought about? Messiah. Right? What else is the time, the Messianic era, if not a time when the whole world comes to recognize the truth? And what does he do instead? He blows it. Right? He
boasts.
Yeah, he boasts. Ray Forman said, you know what? This isn't a punishment. It's not a punishment that Babylon is going to kill. Is going to come back and take them over. It's just a natural consequence. Because think about it. The Jews are never going to be a world superpower. It's a little, tiny little country in the middle of the Middle East. But we can't win, right? We're not going to win in the world of politics. You know how we might win? If we rise above politics. Right? You think about Vatican City, right? Vatican City, right, is technically its own country, right, in the middle of Italy. Right? No one really asks, you know, is Vatican City on one side of the war or another, right? You could have Catholic countries warring each other, right? And Vatican City will still be different. Why? Because they're not about politics, right? We're religious. If you want to influence the world, right, when you're not the world superpower, what you need to do is convince the world that you have something different to bring to the table. And what's that different thing? We have, I don't know, we have truth. And at that moment, Hezekiah could have said to him, look, Babylon, right, you know, it happened because of God. We're not so powerful. We're not. Look at us. Right? How big are we? A little city, a little country. But we have God on our side. And you know what they might have said? Hey, you know, that's really interesting. That makes sense. You know, that makes sense. How else would you have beat Assyria? Or at least there was a chance he would have convinced somebody. And then 50 years later, when Babylon is a rising superpower, right, what might have happened? Babylon might have said, as they're conquering the world, let's leave them alone, because what do we need with them? Right? They're above politics. They're this religious, right? They have a truth. They are religious people. But they don't care about international battles. So what do we care about them? So let them live in peace. Let them pray for us. Right? Right? They don't care who's the superpower. They just want to run their religious revolutions because they have a deeper truth. If he had sung song at that moment and he turned to Babylon and said, yeah, this all happened because of God, then maybe he would have brought them in and brought the Messianic period, but also he would have protected himself. Because then 50 years later, when they're the superpower, what are they going to care about Israel? They know already that Israel isn't in it for power. Instead, what does Hezekiah do? He shows them his palace. He says, look how great of a king I am. I beat Assyria. Look how much wealth I have. And what did Babylon say? Yeah, great. Yeah, very impressive. So wealthy, right? And what did they probably walk away saying? Well, we thought there was something special here, but apparently not. It was just a luck. It was luck, right? Because he's not so powerful. He didn't, right? He's claiming it's his own power. He's just showing us how powerful he is, how rich he is. He's not so powerful. Okay, it was a fluke. It was weird, right? But by not praising God at that moment, what did he do? He said, yeah, I'm part of the regular political discussion. I was just lucky. And that set in motion that, okay, 50 years later, when they're conquering the world, well, Judah's an easy one, and maybe they won't be this lucky that time, and they weren't. So Ray Foreman suggests is that what are the rabbis getting at in the Talmud is that he had a chance and he blew it. He had a chance, first of all, to bring Messiah by bringing in the world to belief of God, but he also had the chance to save himself politically by making it clear that because our fundamental commitments are to God, we don't engage in politics for the sake of politics. That's just a means by which we can create a nation dedicated to God. Because he didn't say that to them, he made them think that he's just another nation. If he's just another nation, then they're going to be conquered like everybody else. He lost the opportunity to step out of world politics, to transcend world politics and start setting a new order. That whether you're Assyria or whether you're Babylon or whether you're Egypt or whatever, we don't care. We just care about our truth. And we want to just be there as an inspiration to the world, whatever is happening politically. But he gave up on it because instead he said, it's me. Right? At that last moment, he lost the opportunity to inspire one last group and thereby protect himself by transcending politics. But he didn't. And if you look at the last thing I put here, right, this was really the lesson you learn from the story is that, right, our goal is not just to recognize that God helps us win victories, but it's to bring that message to the world. Right? Hezekiah slowly did, but he fell short at educating the world. Right? And then if you look at what I put here at 7b, right, this is something I haven't mentioned quite before, we've hinted at it, is Hezekiah also seems to not just be fixing the world, he's going back in time and fixing historical errors. So he goes back, he fixes his father's sins, and then right, he brings people back to the temple and he fixes the sins of Yeravam, the original king of Israel. But he could have actually done one more thing. Right? If Babylon had come and he had said, you know what, it was God, and he brought them to sing together with him, that would have gone back to our first battle, which we discussed 2 weeks ago, right? Which was the Battle of the Sea, which was very much like this. Right? Right? It was the same thing, right? The Jews don't pick up a finger, right? And the world superpower falls, and the Jews sing. But this time, if Hezekiah had sung, right, who would have been there to watch? Right? There was no one to watch in Egypt because they were all dead. But this time there is someone to watch, the next superpower. And if he had brought Babylon into the song, right, he brought them to recognize God, then it wouldn't just be like, right, the song at the sea where Egypt falls and Israel sings to nobody. He would have brought the next superpower, right, as the next superpower was arising, they would have learned the truth of God before, right, before the problems begin, before they get all high on themselves and think that there's nothing above them and they are the great king, Assyria, or the great king of Egypt, right? This was a chance to sing the song at the sea again, but this time while another superpower watched and learned the lessons. But he didn't. So he argues that's really what's happening, is that Hezekiah was great, right? He really was. He brought about this great revolution. He taught the Jewish people that you can do anything with God. But he failed at the last minute because he failed to realize that that you're supposed to get one step further. That recognizing God is behind it is what's supposed to teach us that we also have to teach the world this, and if we, right? And if we can teach the world this, not only will we have achieved our goal as a nation, but we'll also have protected ourselves. Because when you realize that your purpose in the world is not just about politics and battles, and you can transcend it and say there's something deeper, then you can also transcend politics. You can transcend fights. You have the ability to teach the rising superpowers, whoever they might be, that you don't care what's going on with them because there's a deeper truth in the world. If you do that, not only do you teach them truth, but you raise the world, you raise yourself to protect yourself, because the world realizes that you aren't about the mundane. But there Hezekiah fails, right? And there he doesn't sing. He doesn't teach the world. And instead, he sets in motion, right? Not really a punishment, just the inevitable is, okay, if you don't want to transcend politics, you don't want to bring the world in, you don't want the world to appreciate that you have something different to offer, you want to pretend that you're just a power that got lucky, fine. But then you're going to stay stuck in the mire of politics. And in, you know, 30, 40, 50 years, when they're powerful and they're looking to conquer, remember all the stuff you show them in their storehouses, they're remembering, they come back and they're going to take it because you're just another political player and you're not that strong, and they are. And that's really the lesson of this story of Sennacherib, is that God, right, anything is possible with God, but we have to spread that message to the world. And if we do, that gives us the world and the ability to gives us and the world the ability to transcend the mire of politics and really move the world forward. And when we eventually get to the point of Messiah where we can do that, the reason we'll be able to do it is because we'll bring the world with us and we'll transcend the petty, and realizes a deeper goal in the world, which will bring the world to recognize God and protect all of us from the battles that ensue from the petty politics. So that is the story that Lord Byron captured. And as I said, this is why President McNeil said it was that lesson, right, that the world learned, that made it that Judaism and Christianity and Islam could survive, because they knew that about God. We didn't learn quite as early as you could have, but the world did start to learn it, as the religions really did look back to this story to teach them about the nature of God's participation in the world. Okay.